Every civilization has known that the early years are crucial for a child's development. After all, it was the Jesuits in the late Middle Ages who said, "Give me a child until they're seven and they're mine for life." Yet it's a truth we neglect in Britain. Almost a third, 31%, of five-year-olds start primary school without the language, communication and literacy skills they need to thrive. Our early childhood experiences, from our success in catching a ball to reading, shape everything from emotional well-being to lifelong learning. Yet modern parenting often feels like an uphill battle. We are fragmented as a society, and even the traditional nuclear family is no longer strong enough to parent kids successfully. Too many parents find themselves isolated without access to support or the resources they need. So today, we're asking a crucial question. How do we get it right for children in the early years? To help us unpack this, we're joined by Eleanor Ireland, Program Head for Education at the Nuffield Foundation, a leading funder of research and innovation aimed at improving social well-being. Eleanor brings a wealth of experience in early childhood development, education, and the role of evidence in shaping policy and practice. Welcome to the We Society podcast, Eleanor.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm sure the We Society by now did not come out of clear blue sky, but what was your thought when you got the call and you said, "Will you, We Society, what are your thoughts of coming on the We Society podcast? What did that conjure up for you?"
Well, I really like the name, actually. To me, it talks to me about sort of being an inclusive society and an active society where we're all part of it and we all have a responsibility to ourselves and to each other and to the most vulnerable people in society. And at the Nuffield Foundation, we have this really clear mission about vulnerability and social disadvantage. That's the work that we do. And some of the most vulnerable people in society are really young children. So, you know, We as Society really conjures up to me that we all are part of something. We all need to support each other. And young children are very much part of society. They're the future of our society, but they're also part of an active part of our society now.
It's extraordinary. You can encounter people in their 30s, 40s and 50s who are kind of wrestling with issues that they picked up in the first months of their life. It's not widely owned, really, the importance of, inverted commas, early years.
Absolutely. I mean, we're very lucky in that we have discovered through research over the past sort of 20 years or so that the first few years of a child's life are absolutely foundational. It lays the building blocks of their cognitive, physical, emotional and social development for the rest of their lives. So it's really important what happens in children's lives when they're really young. And as you say, you know, we all are affected by our early years throughout the rest of our lives. So what happens in the early years, what happens between the ages of birth and five is really important. And it's something that we're beginning to recognise in our society, but we've got a lot of work to do.
You say beginning. I mean, actually, I'm struck by the fact that most people instinctively know it. What's not happened is it's not been translated into kind of structures and policies and resource. I'm amazed. I mean, whether it's, you know, catching a ball as an 18-month-old, you know, the motor skills to catch a ball successfully and throw it back to your mum and dad, or just by the time you're three, the number of words you've heard. I mean, there's some amazing stats, isn't it, that by the time you're three, a middle-class child will have heard 3 million words more cumulatively than someone who's from a disadvantaged background. And actually, that connects up nodes in their brain at a faster rate than a disadvantaged child. And this disadvantage then extends, just builds cumulatively throughout a life. I mean, it's amazing. And this is the stuff that animates you, yeah?
Absolutely. And what you're talking about is what we call the disadvantage gap. It's something that we talk about a lot in education, and it's really important in early years. And what it means is exactly that difference between a child from a more advantaged background compared to a child from a less advantaged background, and the difference in their development. You can see that difference even before children start school. And really worryingly, there's evidence from the Education Policy Institute that has showed that difference, the disadvantage gap, has actually been widening since 2017. So it's something we really need to be worried about, and something we do really need to address.
What's been driving that? I mean, I guess it's going to be a familiar litany of things. You know, COVID, obviously, inequality of income and wealth, geographical inequalities, and actually the impact also, the differential impact of kind of digitalization and mobile phones. And I'm guessing that actually hard-pressed kind of parents from disadvantaged backgrounds kind of keep their kids silent behind them a mobile phone to look at, whereas you know, middle class say, well, no, I'm going to talk to you. And actually just that act is, in itself is an inequality kind of generator.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really have that much data on what happens in children's homes in relation to sort of language and the way in which their parents talk to them and the role of digital devices. But it's a really key thing that it would be so interesting to find out about. You know, we all hear anecdotes about parents in the park pushing their children on swings whilst they're looking at the phone rather than talking to their children. But I think there's a lot of criticism and sort of judgment about parents that comes into those kind of statements that we all make. Often parents feel quite judged and they know that they should be talking to their kids more, but they're also, you know, we don't know what they're doing on the phone. Could well be working, you know, answering a work email, trying to juggle multiple things. The stresses on parents these days are huge and they're very different to sort of the stresses from years ago. The ways in which we could maybe support parents around their experience and their use of sort of the digital things in their children's lives is offering them an understanding and support about how to, accepting that, you know, mobile phones are part of all of our lives and thinking about how to use them in ways that are healthy and yeah, sort of good for both of us.
Is my own attention span dwindling?
Absolutely. I mean, we're all addicted to our phones.
My brain is being rewired by all. If you're in a kind of position of authority with resource, what would you prioritise with the information you have at hand now? And then what information would you like to additionally gain to inform another round of actions?
I mean, the great thing is that because we've been doing work on early years for such a long time, we've got a lot of evidence about what the problems are, but also what some of the solutions are. So basically, there's been a new policy which has been rolled out by the government. So children from age 9 months up to 5 years old are now entitled to 30 hours of early years education and childcare. So going to a nursery or going to a childminder. And that's available to all parents who are working within sort of certain income brackets, which has made childcare a lot more affordable. It's only just really been rolled out. So it was rolled out, the last wave was implemented in September 2025. We're not quite aware of how parents will respond. There's some sort of discussion that it might just be a matter of changing who pays for childcare. Previously, parents were paying for childcare and now the government's paying for childcare, which parents would have been paying for otherwise. But it also might mean that more parents are going back into work, particularly mothers after having children. And it also might mean that more parents are paying for more childcare on top of what they were using. So it might have a sort of a positive effect on the economy. And it's very likely to, you know, make parents' lives more affordable, you know, reduce some of their bills around childcare.
So good news in this agenda.
Yes, exactly. Yes, good news. And the issue is that it's on top of an early years system, which is really quite a mess, to be honest. It's quite fragmented and it's been pulled in different directions over many years. And some of the key issues are that poorer families who are not entitled to this working families early years education funding are missing out on their childcare, which could be of benefit to them. The other issue is the quality of early years education and childcare is really, really variable. There's also a crisis in the workforce, really high turnover rates, issues with recruitment, very low pay. So there's a kind of a myriad of issues with the early years system. But we do have quite a lot of evidence about how to sort some of these things out. So
you're saying it's a factor that's worrying you is actually the rapid turnover of people who actually work in this sector.
Yes, absolutely. And also the quality. So when we talk about quality, I'll just sort of expand on that slightly. It basically is like the sort of the experience that children have in a nursery. And there are things that we think about, which are things like the size of the groups, the number of staff, staff to child ratios, qualifications that the staff have, and interactions between the staff and the children, and the sort of activities that they do, and generally the experiences that they have. We do know about what sort of quality early years education and childcare looks like for 3 and 4 year olds, but we actually don't know very much about what it looks like for younger children, for babies. And this is, it's really important that we do think about that, because the new government funding means that a lot of government funding is now funding childcare for babies from 9 months old when it hasn't been in the past. And if you think about, you know, the difference between a three-year-old and a nine-month-old,
chalk and cheese.
Yeah, exactly. Three and four-year-olds, they can walk, they can talk, they're toilet trained, they can advocate for themselves, and they do, you know, very audibly at many times. And babies, they can't. They're just learning to talk. They're crawling. They can't sort of feed themselves. Their needs are so totally different. So it's really important that we think about how best to care for these youngest children as well. And we've actually funded some work around that, looking at what babies need.
When you say you funded kind of this research, this is part of what you do at the Nuffield Foundation?
Yes, yeah? Yes, absolutely.
So you're talking about you've done yourself, and how much is it kind of the consequence of funding, of things you've funded? And how much money do you have to spray around? And what's the process?
Oh, well, so unfortunately, I haven't done any of it myself. So we are a grant funder. I would love to claim credit for some of this incredible research. But unfortunately, I don't do any of it myself. So we fund research in the areas of education, welfare and justice. And I work within the education area. And we fund about £10 million or so a year in grants across those three broad areas. And at any one time, I look after maybe 20 or so research grants that are happening about early years. And that's why we've been able to fund a lot of work about the early years system and some of the really key policy issues, because we've got this sort of constant flow of new funds and new findings coming out.
What's the thing you're proudest of in your career that you funded? Or a couple of things, you don't have to single any one thing out, but just, you know, when you reflect,
I mean,
congratulate yourself on.
I am really pleased that we have funded a lot of really of work that's really relevant to sort of current policies. In the past, the government funded a lot more research about sort of policies that it made and did a lot more evaluation, and times have changed and that doesn't happen anymore. But we have been able to fund a lot of work which is providing really key information about some of these new policies, like the work about babies and what kind of care babies need. People think about caring for babies, you know, you're just cuddling them, you're just playing with them, you're changing the odd nappy, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, you know,
they are quite sophisticated.
They
pick up stuff, and they are pick up mood, and they have embedded sense of fairness, and they expect it to be respected. I mean, babies are, as you might expect, they're minute human beings in every way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And unfortunately, the situations that they're being cared for in nurseries often aren't the optimum situations to be able to provide them with high quality care. We know that they need a calm and sort of stimulating environment and a close relationship with the people who are looking after them. So the people who are looking after them need to sort of be quite responsive and attuned to their needs. Some of the research that we've funded from Mona Sacker and Sara Bonetti at the University of Middlesex has shown that often rooms in nurseries have up to sort of on average 13 children, 13 babies in one room, up to 30 children in one room. And you can imagine how busy that is and what that's like, you know, and that the staff child ratio. Exactly. Absolutely. And that, you know, that's not only stressful for staff and affects their ability to care for those children, but you can imagine what that's like for a small baby as well, being looked after in that context. And we also know that often the people working with babies haven't actually had any training about caring for babies. So in early years education training, they will often focus on looking after sort of 2 to 4 year olds. And they also often have lower qualifications than the rest of the early years workforce. So it is quite a worrying situation, really. And it is something that we do need to be thinking about.
Such a tricky area, isn't it? Because actually the people who find caring for babies most rewarding of their mother and father, you're looking out for kind of every hour by hour. Somebody who hasn't got an ongoing relationship, it's kind of nappy changing, stopping them from crying, making sure they're not sick over your clothes. I mean, it's hard to keep them kind of engaged. And yet, from what you're saying, arguably this is the most important months of a child's life.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you could very much understand, given these are such important years of a child's life, why we would want these people to be sort of well-supported and well-trained to care for, you know, some of the most, you know, vulnerable people. They're often really young women working in nurseries with really quite low pay, working in sort of very noisy, quite stressful environments, possibly understaffed, working long hours, their friends and family not really necessarily recognising that this is an important and hard job, you know, seeing it as an easy job, just building blocks all day. You know, they're really dedicated and motivated set of professionals. If you think about all of those stresses, it's hardly surprising there's such a sort of a high turnover rate. And they have such difficulties.
What are the numbers? I mean, you say it's a high turnover rate. Give us an idea what you mean.
There's a really well-recognised recruitment and retention crisis in the early years sector. And Ofsted themselves have said that the earlier sector's losing people working in nurseries and childminders to more highly paid and more flexible employment. And when they leave, they take all of their valuable experience with them. And we know that low pay is a real issue for the workforce. They often have to take on second jobs or become reliant on universal credit or food banks to meet their most basic needs. And that's pretty worrying, really. Some data from a while ago, from 2018, showed that 45% of employees working within early years settings in England were also claiming state benefits or tax credits. You can completely understand why this is such a difficult job when they're working under those kind of situations.
That's sobering.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Are there things that you can identify that one should work on or know about? You know, seem to have some predictive capacity of what's going to happen in the years afterwards?
Early language, we know, is incredibly important. I mean, you were just talking about that. We know that that underlies children's development in a whole range of areas. So not just being able to sort of speak articulately and read, but also in terms of maths and their social and emotional development and their ability to learn in a huge range of other areas. The government have recently set this sort of standard as part of one of their opportunity missions, which is that they'd want 75% of children to reach a good level of development by 2028. And that was something you were talking about earlier, that actually a third of children don't reach that level of development yet.
This season of The Wee Society is brought to you in association with the Nuffield Foundation. For more than 80 years, the Nuffield Foundation has funded research and innovations that sit at the heart of some of society's biggest challenges. Evidence has the power to change lives, whether it's improving educational outcomes, reducing inequality, or understanding how society is changing. The Nuffield Foundation's work helps policymakers and practitioners tackle complex problems. To find out more about the Foundation and its research centres, visit nuffieldfoundation.org.
In my introduction, I talked about the kind of strains of the nuclear family. I was struck, people from the global south saying, well, how do folk in advanced so-called societies actually parent when it's just, you and your partner? I mean, it's extended family in these African villages. We're bringing up the kids, It's a collective effort. And you've actually done it. I don't think people have got any sense of how exhausting it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of, you can't take your eyes off the babe. He, she is kind of demands your attention. You've just got to surrender to it.
Yeah, absolutely. The old adage, it takes a village, is so true. And you really realise that when you have children yourself as well, that it's really hard raising kids without any family around you and any kind of like support, really. We did have a really good system of support for families through Sure Start a few years ago in this country. And that has now been replaced by a new approach called Family Hubs, which is sort of taking some of the lessons learned from Sure Start.
So has Sure Start been rebranded as Family Hubs? I thought Sure Start was carrying on and Family Hubs were coming in alongside Sure Start.
I mean, most Sure Start centres have been closed and quite a few Sure Start centres have now been churned into Family Hubs.
Right.
And there's also areas which didn't have Sure Start centres where new Family Hubs have been set up. But they, I mean, we can't really think of Family Hubs as a replacement for Sure Start centres. They're trying to do something similar in that they are sort of an area-based offer to families and they provide sort of, advice about childcare and parenting support, employment support, benefits, that kind of thing. But in some cases, what they do is online. It's a digital thing, whereas Sure Start centres were all in person. And the funding is really different. The funding at the peak of Sure Start for Family Hubs is only a third of what it was for Sure Start. And family hubs that also cover a much wider age range from 0 to 19, whereas Sure Start was focused on much younger children. So although it's a good place to start to recognise, you know, we've got all this amazing evidence about how Sure Start has had these really long-term benefits on children's educational attainment at age 7 and 11, and even when they got to their GCSEs.
And keeping them well.
Absolutely. It reduced hospitalisations when children who lived in Sure Start centres when they became teenagers and had improvements on their mental health as well. So we know that Sure Start and this kind of integrated family support really, really helps families. And family hubs are a good place to start, but it's probably not realistic to think that they will be able to have the same benefits as Sure Start did.
I'm also being struck, and maybe that's the age I am, a lot of my friends are very active grandparents.
Mm.
And that, again, is a way in which inequality kind of manifests itself, because not everyone who's got grandparents or your parents just can't be grandparents because they've either died or they're too ill or they're just not capable of doing it.
Or live too far away as well. That's a really common situation these days, isn't it? You know, people are bringing up children without that kind of wider network of family support. And you know, where you do have grandparents available, that's a really lucky situation to be in. You know, grandparents' role in children's lives, that's not a new thing, is it? My sense is that is something that's possibly diminishing as, you know, the time at which people have children gets older and therefore grandparents are older and less able to kind of be active and be well and looking after their children.
Yeah, taking on grandparenting roles when you're 80s is not...
Absolutely. It's hard work when you're in your 30s and 40s, you know, so...
So let's discuss this. I mean, family structure, children's development, the role for the state...
Mm.
What the best areas of intervention are, that's what you do.
Yeah.
What do you feel that you want to find out about? I mean, where does it go next? Where does this debate go next? What research are you going to commission?
It's a really interesting question. There's a lot we do have answers for. There's a lot of evidence, robust evidence we have about sort of, you know, how to make some of these things work in the early years. But there is a lot that we don't know about, of course. One of the issues, it relates to special educational needs and disabilities. You know, we know that there has been, from sort of government data, that there's been a big increase in the number of children being sort of diagnosed or receiving special educational needs and disabilities support when they get to school. And that's things like developmental delays, neurodivergence like autism and ADHD, sort of communication difficulties, social emotional difficulties. We don't have much data and we don't know that much about it in the early years and when before children start school. And we don't really know that much about what the reasons are for this big rise. So some of it could be people are more aware of these things now and there's sort of some kind of better identification. That's definitely part of what's going on. There could also be other things that are causing it that we're unaware of, you know, sort of increasing pressures on families of the sort of hangover effects of COVID. And we also know that the disadvantage gap that we were talking about earlier, evidence from the Education Policy Institute shows that the disadvantage gap for children with special educational needs and disabilities at age 5 has been widening it over the last 10 years. So there's not only more children in this situation, but actually they're doing worse than they were. And that's an area we really need to do some research on and really need to find out more about.
But what do you expect to find? I mean, do you expect to find it all about income? Do you find it? I mean, what's going to be the driver of this?
We don't know. I mean, finding out what the driver is useful, but also the work that we fund has to be kind of solution focused. So what we'd want to find out is what support do these children need and how can we equip the people working with them, the health visitors, the people working in nurseries, how can we equip them to work with those children and support those families so that we can kind of mitigate some of the sort of issues that they're dealing with.
And some of your work goes right back to the kind of first days that too early discharge from a maternity unit. I mean, I found this very revelatory, really, that, you know, that the 2 days versus 10 days could make such conspicuous difference to a child's life chances. And you're talking about the first days of life.
Mm. And we know that even, you know, in the prenatal period before children are even born, the experiences that the mother goes through is sort of in terms of sort of like, you know, stress levels and her general sort of life and nutrition and all those kind of things can have an impact on children. That's actually a piece of work that we're funding at the moment that unfortunately we haven't got the results from yet, but is looking at the impact of sort of these prenatal experiences on children's educational outcomes and what happens later on with a view to trying to work out how to better support mothers when they're pregnant to give their children sort of the best chance later on. But I mean, the other side of that is that when people are pregnant, it's an incredibly stressful time and you're constantly worried about like, oh, what if I've done this that's hurt the baby? What if I've done that that's hurt the baby? So, you know, we need to kind of be really careful about supporting, but also reassuring and reducing people's stress.
Two of the people I share a season ticket for the football. He brought a friend of his along and they were claiming that they'd formed a prenatal friendship because both their mothers went to the same kind of mothering kind of advice centre when they were young. But there's some truth in it, I think, maybe.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we know that in those early days before children are born and also when children are very new, you know, having social support for mothers is really, really important. We know that mothers' mental health has a really big impact.
The baby's forming a relationship with the
womb. Yeah. I mean, or it's, you know, the mothers are forming friendships and then that has the you know, the impact and the social support and the emotional support that that friendship has, you can imagine may well then kind of translate into those children.
Is all this work radicalising you? I mean, it is so important.
Mm.
And actually making people realise it's important is really hard. Although actually there has been, I think, a bit of a change in the culture.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you sometimes want to kind of thump the table and scream at the world? I mean, take this agenda much more seriously.
I mean, for many years, that has kind of been the situation. We've had a lot of evidence about how important early childhood is, and there haven't been much funding directed towards it. And it has actually been quite difficult to make the case for why we need to support the youngest people in society. But actually, recently the government has released a new strategy called Best Start in Life, which is showing some sort of fairly promising signs. It's looking at how to support families more widely through sort of family hubs. And the other thing, which is really quite new, is that they're focusing on the early years workforce and improving quality of early years education and trying to increase the number of graduates and the number of teachers and improve the qualifications that the early years workforce have. That's quite a change, really, in recent years in terms of where early years policy has been. And it is quite encouraging. I mean, it's quite top level at the moment, so we're going to have to see what they say in terms of these sort of top-level promises, how they actually manifest and whether they're able to tackle some of these really tricky ingrained issues. But, you know, I'm feeling a lot more hopeful than I was maybe a few years ago.
I do think that in my adult life, I think the role of fathers has been much better understood. And,
yeah.
And fathers, and I got 2 days off when my kids arrived.
Oh my goodness.
Quite. And I wasn't sure whether to take them because would I be looked down? Would that be frowned on? I mean, that discourse is completely gone.
Yeah.
There is the investment you've discussed. And there is the recognition that actually what's going on in a baby's brain is actually kind of fundamental to where they're going to go in life, actually.
Yeah.
Is this one of those podcasts where we can end on an optimistic note?
I mean, I think so. What the government's doing at the moment in terms of this Best Start in Life strategy, it is fairly hopeful, and a lot of it is quite evidence-based. So they are recognising some of these sort of really entrenched issues, and they are making the right sounds in terms of that they are going to be addressing some of them. Whether or not it'll be enough remains to be seen. The early years is 5 years. It's a short period of a person's life, but we know how important it is and how fundamental it is for not only for the rest of their life and their families, but for the whole of society. And it's really important that we take it seriously and we invest in that period in children's lives.
And in a way, and this is a social science podcast, not in a way, it is social science at work in a beneficial way.
Absolutely.
Do you see yourself as a social scientist?
Social scientist, yeah. I come from a social research background, so that's. I do see myself as a social scientist.
And what compelled you to get involved in this area?
I really like trying to understand sort of what some of the issues are in society and how we could solve them and how we can kind of better understand what is affecting real people's lives and what government and sort of policymakers and practitioners and everything the state provides, how they can support people.
Is there an event in your life that's made you more convinced that this is something that could be taken seriously? Your own experience of motherhood or...
I mean, I was lucky enough to experience Sure Start when my children, with my older child, we lived in an area where there were good Sure Start centres, and then we moved to an area where, and also, you know, my times had changed and lots of Sure Start centres had closed. So I kind of experienced the peak of that policy and then also when that policy had disappeared quite a lot. And the difference in the experience and the support that was available to me as a new mum at that time was really remarkable. And, you know, I'm probably not the sort of target audience of Surestart, but even so, you know, just experiencing that incredible support was really fundamental.
One of the things I liked about Surestart was its design, in that it put so much control of how resources were allocated. And the whole thing was kind of run by founders.
Yeah.
Rather than local government or government officials. It was really engaged local people.
I mean, that was one of the things that was criticised about Surestart, in that they were all quite different in the way that, in the things that they did, but also one of the really beneficial ways that they were able to work, and that they could recognise what people who lived there, who lived nearby, needed, what the parents needed there, and they could do things that address their needs directly. And that's sort of, you know, one of the reasons that it's recognised as being so successful, in that they were able to sort of detect issues early on, they were able to support families directly, and they were able to kind of change families' relationships with local services. So families were known to local services in the way that they maybe hadn't been before, but also maybe built up a sense of trust and got to know all of the things that were on offer that they wouldn't have done otherwise.
Just before we sign off, I don't want to leave this question of special needs lying there unattended. There's been an explosion in special needs demands, and I don't understand how you address it. Is the thing to do to get at this kind of earlier, when kids are 2, 3, 4 years old? I mean, what's your thinking?
Well, firstly, we don't really know as yet why this is happening, or particularly sort of what is going on, what are the causes behind it. But you're absolutely right, getting to it earlier. And I know we keep on talking about Surestart, but one of the findings of Surestart was that in areas where there were Surestart centres, there were actually higher rates of special educational needs support when children were 5. So it looked like, oh, there's a bit of a rise in special educational needs, what's going on? But then by the time they were sort of between the ages of 7 and 16, the special education needs support had gone down, which suggests that issues were being identified early, children were getting support early on, and then this support wasn't needed as they were getting older. And, you know, if you think about that in the context of COVID, where we were all stuck at home, children weren't necessarily getting support. That could be one of the reasons behind, because of this lack of support early on. So that's why it's really important to think about special educational needs in the early years.
So the last word, invest. In our children, and invest in particular in our children between 0 and 5.
Absolutely.
Eleanor, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast. Leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, and thank you so much for listening.